slave of the most elementary kind. He must also be willing to spend most of every day alone in the jungle. The Serengeros day started before the sun rose, when he stumbled through the black forest carrying a curved knife and wearing the kind of headlamp that miners rely on as they descend into the bowels of the earth. As the tapper pushed through the dense vegetation, he could see only a few feet in front of him. Everything beyond, beside, or behind the arc of his headlamp was cloaked in absolute darkness. Even in the full light of day, the trails that he had blazed to his rubber trees were difficult to discern. In the pre-dawn hours, with nothing but the thin, trembling light of his headlamp to illuminate the forest, they were all but invisible, as were the dangers that waited on branches, under fallen logs, and in the very air. By 10 a.m., a typical tapper had visited between 150 and 180 trees, attaching small zinc bowls to the trees to capture the latex as it oozed out of the incision. He then had to retrace his steps in the afternoon, making his way through the steaming jungle to each tree so that he could collect the latex. When he returned home in the evening, more hot, miserable work awaited him. Hunched over a heavy, oily smoke that rolled from a palm nut fire, he poured the latex onto a rough wooden spit that he turned over and over, until it slowly coagulated in thin, even layers. It could take weeks of this relentless work to produce a single ball of rubber that was heavy enough, between 60 and 150 pounds, to be sold. As difficult for the Serengeros as their hardscrabble existence was the knowledge that what little they had managed to build could be taken away from them at a moment's notice. They did not have anything other than squatters' rights to the land on which they lived and worked, and so were constantly vulnerable to the threat of a wealthier, savvier man sweeping into their territory brandishing a title to all that they had thought they owned. The Serengeros themselves, of course, thought nothing of taking land from the Indians who had lived on it for millennia. Besides Rondon, few Brazilians at that time believed that the Amazonian Indians had any rights at all, certainly not to something as valuable as land. The men's jubilation at discovering the cut vine on April 11th turned into tense anticipation as days passed with no other signs of the Serengeros, and the expedition encountered one series of rapids after another, the kind of rapids that they had dared to hope were behind them. Then, on April 15th, good fortune returned in what was, in Roosevelt's words, a red-letter day. After launching their boats that morning and traveling for 2.5 hours, the men spotted a rough plank affixed to a stake on the left bank of the river. Dizzy with excitement, they quickly pulled their dugouts over to investigate. They soon discovered that there were actually two markers, one on each side of the river, and burned into both were the initials J.A. An hour later, they saw a house. It was a very simple house, made of palm thatch with a smaller hut next to it for rubber smoking. But there was no confusing it with the Indian huts that they had seen upriver. It was, in the eyes of the men, a herald of the outside world. Shouts of exultation went up from our canoes as this frail outpost of civilization met our eyes, Cherry wrote. The house belonged to a Serengero named Joaquim Antonio, the tapper whose markers they had seen on the riverbank, and the belongings inside indicated that he had a wife and child. Much to the dismay of the members of the expedition, however, the house was deserted. Not only were the men eager to meet a rubber tapper, but the sight of food stored inside was excruciating, because, without Antonio's permission, Rondon would not let them take even a single yam. So none of the provisions were touched, Cherry wrote, although we were sadly in need of some things for our camaradas. Little more than a mile downstream, a single small canoe appeared in front of them, carried along by the swift current like a fallen tree branch. The sight sent a rush of excitement through the four dugout flotilla, but it was not excitement that burned in the chest of the Serengero in the canoe. Looking up to find a line of dugout canoes coming toward him from the direction of the river's mysterious headwaters, Raimundo José Marquez, an old black man who lived alone on the banks of the River of Doubt, turned his boat and paddled quickly toward the shore. When Rondon saw Marquez, he jumped out of his seat, snatched the cap off his head, and began waving it like a flag, shouting to the Serengeru that there was nothing to fear, they were not Indians. Fortunately for the expedition, Marquez did not disappear into the jungle as soon as he reached the bank. Instead, he stood at the river's edge and listened to Rondon. After a few minutes, he climbed back into his canoe and slowly paddled over to the strange flotilla. Upon reaching it, he tried to explain to Rondon the terror that had driven him ashore. It was quite impossible for him to expect the arrival of civilized people descending the river from its source, Rondon later wrote. Marquez's description of the members of the expedition as civilized people only underscored how far the men still were from a settled area. To anyone who had not spent years in the wilderness, the men would have looked almost inhuman. After weeks of surviving on little more than a few bites of fish and a single biscuit each night, they were gaunt and hollow-cheeked. The clothes on their backs, the only clothing they had left, were in tatters. And wherever their skin appeared, it was bruised, cut, sunburned, and peppered with insect bites. They were filthy and wild-eyed from disease and fear, and their American commander was barely clinging to life. By this point, Roosevelt was so sick that he could no longer even sit up in his canoe. Neither, however, could he lie down. Each of the four dugouts was packed with men and supplies, and there was not an empty space in any of them. The former president had been reduced to painfully balancing on a row of hard-edged metal food canisters that had been covered with a mud-encrusted canvas sheet. The canvas would have been put to better use as a tent to shield Roosevelt from the tropical sun, but the camaradas had no way to rig it up in the tiny dugout. The best they could do was to place his heavy but crumbling pith helmet over his face, trading the glaring sun for suffocating black heat. Not only was Roosevelt's pain intense, but he and the doctor both knew that if they did not reach help soon, he would die. In the weeks since Roosevelt had injured his leg while trying to help free the trapped canoes, he had developed a potentially deadly bacterial infection, which thrives in a wet, warm environment. There was no more perfectly engineered growth medium for this infection than the rainforest. When Roosevelt had sliced his leg open on the river boulder, the defensive barrier that the skin forms against outside bacteria had been broken, and there was little that Cajazeira could do to shore it up. The infection had spread rapidly, and by early April, Roosevelt was in grave danger. The skin around his wound had become red, swollen, hot, and hard, and a deep pus-filled abscess had formed on the soft inner portion of his lower thigh. His blood pressure had dropped, and his heart rate had risen. As his temperature soared and he lay on his cot, sweating and shaking, it was at times difficult to tell if he was suffering from another attack of malaria or enduring the agonies of his infection. Cajazeira hovered over Roosevelt as though he were his mother, taking his temperature, cleaning and bandaging his wound, and injecting him with quinine. But the doctor had almost nothing with which to fight the growing infection. "We administered the palliative medication employed in these cases," he wrote. "Nevertheless, day by day his condition worsened, and we started to become seriously concerned. If left untreated or treated inadequately, the infection could lead to blood poisoning and, ultimately, death. The best defense would have been an antibiotic, but even penicillin, one of the first antibiotics, would not be discovered for another 14 years, and would not be widely prescribed until World War II. Cajazeira wanted to operate on Roosevelt's leg, but Roosevelt was reluctant to undergo surgery. The Rough Rider was less concerned that the doctor would not be able to give him anesthesia of any kind. He had refused anesthetic during the operation on his left leg 12 years earlier, than that the operation would be performed in an environment teeming with bacteria and disease-carrying insects. "As was only natural, Colonel Roosevelt asked us to postpone surgery, hoping he would be cured without the need for such intervention," Cajazeira wrote. "We agreed, clearly explaining, however, that we did not believe in such an outcome." So sick was the former president that, When Raimundo José Marquez paddled over to the expedition, Roosevelt could not lift himself out of his canoe to meet him. His condition, however, did not diminish the old Seringueiro's awe when he learned that the ragged and stricken man he saw lying in the roughest sort of dugout canoe had once been the President of the United States. Astonished, Marquez said to Rondon, "But is he really a president?" Rondon explained that Roosevelt was not president any longer, but had once been. "Ah," Marquez replied, "he who has once been a king has always the right of majesty." Marquez, who was among the poorest of the river's rubber tappers, had no food that he could share with the starving men, but he did give them some valuable advice. Upon approaching a settler, he instructed them, they should signal their peaceful intent by firing one of their guns 3 times in a row, and then blowing on a bamboo horn that he would give them as a gift. The Seringueros, who lived along the River of Doubt, had had little more interaction with the local Indians than had the members of the expedition, but their fear was not theoretical. Most of the time, the Cinta Larga remained invisible, revealing themselves to the settlers only in brief glimpses in scattered locations. They had, however, appeared to the tappers who lived along this stretch of the river on one occasion, and the result had been disastrous. A frightened Seringueiro named Manuel Vieira, who lived in a hut just below Marquez's, had met some approaching Indians with a rain of gunfire. Soon after, the Indians had responded in kind, riddling Vieira with poisonous arrows. "After this fact, no other of such gravity had occurred," Rondon wrote. But the rubber tappers did not deceive themselves with regard to the tranquility which they were enjoying. The panic caused by our arrival clearly shows the degree of nervous tension in which those people live, constantly tormented by the expectation of seeing the warlike Indians springing forth from the wilderness. As they continued down the river, the men were as agitated and high-strung as the settlers they expected to see at any moment. The rain began again, filling the bottoms of their dugouts with muddy water and drenching Roosevelt. Suddenly, out of the monotony of the river's sounds, the water sloshing against the side of his canoe, the occasional grunts of his men as they dug their paddles into the black river, a roar of elation erupted all around him. The men had spotted another house along the riverbank, and this time, someone was home. From their canoes, the men could see smoke billowing from the chimney and 2 small children playing outside. Before Rondon could snatch up his rifle and bamboo horn, the children had looked up from their games, noticed the expedition coming toward them, and disappeared into their house. A moment later, they reappeared with their mother at their side. Seeing his opportunity and hoping to reassure the woman before she panicked, Rondon fired 3 shots into the air and blew heavily into the old Seringueiro's horn. "Unfortunately," he wrote, "this precaution did not have the desired effect." So deep-seated was the Seringueiro's fear of the Cinta Larga that, when the mother of the 2 children looked at the expedition's weak and exhausted men, she not only saw fierce Indians in their place in the canoes, but believed she heard their war whoops echoing through the forest. Terrified, she scooped her children up into her arms and fled downriver, desperately trying to reach her neighbor's house, where she knew she would find her husband. Driven by fear and blinded by the rain, she stumbled along a rough dirt path that skirted the river's edge until she tripped and fell into a stream that bisected it. The men watched helplessly from their canoes, their efforts to reassure her only heightening her distress. "She succeeded in getting up with her clothes drenched," Rondon wrote, "and continued her wild race until she arrived at the house of a neighbor, where she fainted." As soon as she could talk, the woman told her husband, a rubber tapper named Honoratu, that their house was under attack by Indians. Believing that the confrontation that he had long feared had finally happened, Honoratu wasted no time. He and 3 of his neighbors armed themselves, climbed into a canoe, and made their way upstream prepared for a bloody battle. As they neared the house, the rain was still coming down and the sun had begun to set, but Honoratu could see the fire that his wife had built in preparation for their evening meal, and he could see men standing just outside his door. He and the other men in his canoe silently pulled through the dark water until they reached the bank. Climbing through the soup of mud and half-decomposed leaves under their feet, they sought cover in the thick woods, where they could wait unseen until the moment was right to attack. As the light of the fire flickered over the faces of the men who had invaded his home, however, Onoratu began to realize that something was not right. These men were not Indians. This realization, and Onoratu's willingness to step forward and investigate rather than take cover and shoot, very likely saved the lives of many of the men in the expedition that night. Stepping inside, Onoratu found Theodore Roosevelt and Brazil's greatest explorer resting in his home, while a group of starving and exhausted men made dinner over his wife's fire. Although their first meeting had nearly ended in tragedy, the Onoratus and their neighbors proved to be extremely valuable to the men of the expedition. They were, Roosevelt wrote, most hospitable to their unexpected guests. And as Raimundo Marquez had promised, they agreed to sell the expedition provisions and two large canoes, and they helped them hire a guide. Onoratu also explained to the men exactly where they were. The River of Doubt, the western branch of the Aripuanan, was known to the Serengeros as the Castanha. Ironically, the Portuguese word for Brazil nut, the nuts that the men had searched so desperately for upriver. Even at this point, however, the river was not known to anyone but the settlers and Indians who lived on it. It was astonishing, Roosevelt wrote, when we were on a river of about the size of the Upper Rhine or Elbe, to realize that no geographer had any idea of its existence. But, after all, no civilized man of any grade had ever been on it. The Onoratus invited the men to spend the night at their home. It seemed, as Antonio Correa said to Kermit, like a dream to be in a house again and hear the voices of men and women instead of being among those mountains and rapids. The reminder of all that they had missed over the past 2 months and were missing still was painful. Even the sight of a brood of chicks hopping around the Onoratu's simple hut and pecking at the forest floor stirred Cherry to the core. How nice it was to see them, he wrote in his diary. How it made me think of home. Sitting outside after the first real meal that they had had in weeks, Cherry and Kermit shared the scotch they had been saving to celebrate the first signs of deliverance from their river journey. As the alcohol slipped down their throats and filled their chests with a warm flush, they looked up into the dark southern sky and saw the familiar outline of the Big Dipper suspended among the other stars. Upside down, to be sure, but how good it looks, Cherry wrote. While the men celebrated their warm reception by the rubber men and savored the prospect of returning to their loved ones in the outside world, they understood only part of the good fortune that had brought them down the River of Doubt alive. As significant as their own efforts had been in triumphing over the churning river and the unforgiving rainforest that surrounded it, the men remained unaware of the single most important factor in their survival: the decision of the Cinta Larga to let them go. From the moment they had begun their river journey, their presence had been the subject of ongoing discussion and debate within the clannish communities of Cinta Larga that lined the River of Doubt, provoking a range of reactions from curiosity to fear to covetous fascination with their strange tools and clothing. The ability of the Cinta Larga tribesmen to destroy the expedition and all its members was never in doubt. Despite their simplicity, the Indians' weapons were marvels of efficient lethality, refined over thousands of years of experience, to kill silently and swiftly. If their poisoned arrows were not enough to dispense with Roosevelt and his men, every Cinta Larga warrior had a lifetime of practice with the war clubs that were carefully designed to dispatch any survivors with a single, savage blow. The men of the expedition were armed with modern firearms, to be sure, but in the dark jungle, at night, when the Cinta Larga preferred to surprise their enemies, there was little chance that Roosevelt or his men would ever have seen their attackers. From the moment they launched their boats on the River of Doubt, the expedition had repeatedly encountered signs of the Indians' presence, passing through their villages, discovering their trail markings, examining their arrows, even hearing their voices. But not once had they so much as glimpsed a single tribesman. Like the other inhabitants of their rainforest, the Xintalarga had worked for countless generations to perfect the art of disappearing in the riot of nature that surrounded them. For each member of the tribe, just like every other creature in the jungle, the advantage of concealment was a critical tool of survival that was painstakingly conserved and surrendered only when the payoff was large and certain. In a world of unpredictable, resourceful enemies, invisibility was not merely advantageous, but a matter of life and death. A single unguarded moment could be fatal, and the only look that an enemy was likely to get of a Xintalarga warrior was a colorful flash of feathers and war paint before a swift and violent death. The same preoccupation with concealment that made the Xintalarga so terrifyingly invisible to the expedition, however, also reflected the underlying conservatism that all rainforest inhabitants must exhibit when confronted by new or unfamiliar events. The survival instincts of virtually all jungle creatures favor flight or concealment over attack, and the Xintalarga were no exception. Weighed against the uncertain benefits of any confrontation with the expedition, the risks of undertaking such an action and exposing themselves and their villages to potential danger were great. This was especially true because the expedition appeared to be moving steadily through their territory, without posing any specific threat. It seems likely that the benign character of the expedition was also reinforced by Rondon's repeated attempts to reassure the Indians of his friendly intentions by leaving gifts for them at every opportunity. From the start of the expedition's journey down the River of Doubt, these conflicting factors had produced a deep division of opinion between those Indian elders who wanted to kill the members of the expedition and those who favored waiting to see if they would pass peacefully out of the Xintalarga's territory without provoking a confrontation. Given the tribe's tradition that all decisions of war be made by consensus, the very existence of this debate became the thin thread on which the lives of Roosevelt and his men would ultimately hang. As the men of the expedition looked up at the clear black sky above the River of Doubt and marveled at the brilliant stars which pointed their way home, they neither knew nor likely even suspected who was actually responsible for their safe passage out of the jungle. In the dark, liana-draped trees that towered on all sides around the tiny wooden shack in which the men fell off to sleep, the warriors of the Xintalarga, with painted bodies, hard bark belts, and poison-tipped arrows, slipped away as silently and invisibly as they had come. Obeying the timeless calculus of survival in the rainforest, they disappeared on swift, bare feet into endless dark halls of leaf and vine. For their own reasons, and on their own terms, they would let these enemies live. Chapter 29. A Pair of Flags. According to the expedition's Serengeru hosts, it would take another 15 days for the men to reach the confluence of the River of Doubt and the Aripuanan, where the men hoped that Lieutenant Piraneus would be waiting. After they had spent a month and a half alone on the most treacherous and least known stretch of the river, another 2 weeks traveling through Serengeru territory might have seemed like a frustrating but relatively easy journey. If they could not catch food, they would be able to buy it. And if they lost another canoe, they could purchase one from a rubber tapper. What they would not find, however, was a hospital. And 15 days was a long time to keep alive a man as sick as Theodore Roosevelt. In fact, none of the men, with the notable exception of the seemingly invincible Rondon, was healthy. Cherry and Lyra had battled nearly constant dysentery. Kermit had fought repeated attacks of malaria. Half of the camaradas were so sick with fever that they could no longer work. Even those who were still on their feet, Kermit noted in his diary, were working poorly and lifelessly. Only a few of the men had retained their original physical and moral strength, Roosevelt wrote. Fear, disease, and hunger had driven them to do things that they never would have done under any other circumstances. They had agreed to abandon one of their own to almost certain death in the jungle. They had stolen food from their fellow camaradas. They had scoured the forest in search of anything that might be even remotely edible. Just 2 days earlier, several of the camaradas had devoured some unidentified nuts that they had found while they were hunting, and had become dangerously ill. As sick as his men were, even Roosevelt himself had to admit that he was in worse shape than anyone else in the expedition. He continued to fight for his life for his son's sake, but he had no illusions about the gravity of his condition. And he had never faltered in his resolve that not a single life in the expedition be risked in an effort to save his own. "If I am to go, it's all right," he told Cajazeira. "You see that the others don't stop for me. I've the shortest span of life ahead of any in the party. If anyone is to die here, I must be the one." Roosevelt's condition had become so alarming and his pain had become so unbearable that on April 16th, he finally agreed to allow Cajazeira, the man he trusted most on this expedition after Cherry and his own son, to operate on his leg. The operating room floor was nothing more than the muddy soil of the riverbank. Using only the simplest of surgical tools and no anesthetic, Cajazeira sliced deep into his patient's leg, releasing a mottled mixture of blood and foul-smelling pus that had collected in the abscess. As the doctor worked to insert a drainage tube, swatting away the legions of piums and borashudo flies that had been attracted to the stench, Roosevelt did not cry out in pain or utter a word of complaint. "Father's courage was an inspiration never to be forgotten by any of us," Kermit would later write. With each passing day, the expedition's situation improved just enough to keep the men's spirits buoyed and their determination strong. They also had the good fortune of meeting a serengero named Barboso, a simple man with a dusky cigar-smoking wife and his many children, who awed the men of the expedition with his generosity. Refusing any payment, despite his own conspicuous poverty, Barboso gave the men a duck, a chicken, manioc, and 6 pounds of rice. He also lent them a boat, doubtless one of his most valuable possessions, and accepted in return one of the poorly constructed dugouts they had made themselves. 2 days later, the expedition was able to gain another boat by trading 2 more of its dugouts to serengeros it met along the river. With a local rubber tapper to guide them, new canoes to carry them, and plenty of food to sustain them, what the men needed most now was speed. Although the operation to lance Roosevelt's abscess had been successful, easing some of his pain as well as Cajazeira's concern, the former president was still dangerously ill. The bacterial infection had continued to spread, and he had developed another abscess, this one on his right buttock. "We did what was reasonable in such an emergency to prevent another abscess," Cajazeira wrote, "but to no avail." Roosevelt's familiar fat-cheeked face and barrel-chested physique looked deflated, as if the journey had stripped not just strength from his body, but years from his life. After months of deprivation and starvation, when the men had finally reached a place where they could eat all that they wanted, Roosevelt had little interest in eating anything at all. "He eats very little," Cherry fretted in his diary. "He is so thin that his clothes hang like bags on him." In just 3 months, Roosevelt had lost 55 pounds, 1/4 of his original body weight. In stark contrast to their American commander, the men of the expedition had difficulty restraining themselves when offered food of any size, shape, or origin. They rejoiced when they found a broken-down river store, even though its shelves were nearly empty and what little was there had been carted in nearly a year before. At exorbitant cost, the men bought and feasted on such luxuries as sugar and condensed milk. Several of the camaradas drank entire cans of condensed milk in long, sticky swallows. In this land of plenty, the camaradas overate, Roosevelt wrote, and sickness was as rife among them as ever. The only food that interested Roosevelt was some eggs that he found and ate raw in a dingy little shack where the men stopped for the night on April 23rd. "Our stopping place, filthy, wet, and dark," Cherry wrote in disgust. "Pigs, chickens, and dogs contend for a place." But spending the night with the animals was better than sleeping in another downpour, and it was worth any price to see Roosevelt eat something, anything. After months of worrying about his father, Kermit was now obsessed with the thought that, after all they had been through, he might not be able to bring him home alive. Concern over Roosevelt's condition increased the next day, when the expedition had to halt because of a long and treacherous series of waterfalls. These falls, known to the Serengeros as Carupanan, began with half a dozen rapids. Their guide could not help them here, and the men knew that if they were forced to stumble slowly and blindly through these rapids, as they had done dozens of times before, it would take them at least 2 weeks to push past Carupanan. It was painfully apparent to his men that Roosevelt would not survive such a long and harrowing ordeal. Men much younger and stronger than he had died attempting to cross the Carupanan Falls, and their buried remains still lay at the edge of the rapids, a sobering reminder that the expedition was not yet beyond the grasp of the River of Doubt. The men of the expedition, however, like the men who had come before them, had no choice but to take their chances in the falls. Ahead of them lay either death or deliverance. At the top of the rapids, the men found a store that was owned by José Caripe, a man who, in Cherry's words, reigned as the king of the rubber gatherers on the River of Doubt. Caripe had begun his career as a lowly serengero, but was now, through hard work and presumably hard dealings, a patron or boss. Most of the tappers along this stretch of river worked for him, giving him rubber in exchange for tools and provisions from his store. Caripe was exactly what the expedition needed. Roosevelt immediately recognized the Brazilian as his kind of man, describing him as cool, fearless, and brawny as a bull. Not only was he a self-made man, working his way up from extreme poverty to relative power and wealth, but he had faced down the dangers of the jungle with courage and even bravado, proving himself to be almost Rondon-like in his invincibility, if not in his interests or motivations. When he heard that the expedition was about to pass through Carupanan, and he saw the condition that Roosevelt was in, Caripe proposed that he himself should guide the men to the foot of the falls. They gratefully accepted his offer and were thrilled when he also gave them one of his own well-made boats in exchange for the last of their dugout canoes. With Caripe's guidance and the use of their 3 new lightweight boats, it took the men only a day and a half to pass through the series of rapids. Along those stretches of the river that were at all navigable, Caripe effortlessly guided them to the safest channels. Where the rapids were impassable, he showed them trails that had already been cut through the heavy jungle. The Carupanan Falls demanded several difficult portages, and it nearly claimed one of their new canoes. But in the end, the men lost only one member of their expedition. Kermit's dog, Trigero, who wandered off into the jungle while his master was busy preparing to run the boats through a set of rapids. It was a loss that, for Kermit, was particularly painful so close to the end of the journey. But in what had become an all-out race against time, nothing mattered now but getting Roosevelt to Manaus, where, his son desperately hoped, the ex-president's life might yet be saved. On the afternoon of April 26th, the expedition passed through a stretch of the forest that had been partially submerged. The dark, murky river, which was still swollen from the rainy season downpours, swirled around the thick tree trunks and swallowed whole the small islands that held them aloft. Looking into the distance, the men suddenly saw a row of neat tents lined up along one of the banks. Standing among those tents were Lieutenant Pirineus and the 6 men of his relief party, who had established their tiny camp at the confluence of the 2 branches of the Aripuanan 6 weeks earlier. Since that time, their fears had risen like the waters of the swollen river as day after day, and then week after week, had passed with no sign of their colonel and his expedition. When the men on the river and the men on the shore finally spotted one another, shouts of joy rang through the forest, and rifle reports shook the leaves of the sunken trees. Lying under his makeshift tent, Roosevelt pulled himself up with quivering arms to witness his own rescue. What he saw before him were two flags outlined against a sharp blue sky. First, the green, gold, and blue of Rondon's beloved Republic of Brazil. Then, fluttering beside them, the stars and stripes that had for so long driven and defined Roosevelt's own life, and whose promise stirred him still. Epilogue. On the afternoon of May 19, 1914, just 3 weeks after his expedition's emotional reunion with Lieutenant Pyrineus on the banks of the River of Doubt, Roosevelt triumphantly entered New York Harbor on the steamship Aden, all flags flying. As he leaned over the deck railing, smiling his toothy smile, waving his big Panama hat, and, in a gesture for which he had become famous, vigorously shaking hands with himself, every watercraft in the harbor that had a whistle blew three long, joyful blasts. Although Roosevelt's homecoming was an occasion of great joy for everyone, from his wife to his children to the journalists who had followed him for decades, the sight of the former president, thin, drawn, and leaning on a cane, which he jokingly referred to as his big stick, came as a shock. He was, one reporter wrote, brown as the saddle that formed part of his luggage. But his dark tropical tan covered a face that had lost its youthful fullness and gained a network of new, deeply etched lines. Physically, at least, Theodore Roosevelt was not the same man he had been when he left New York nearly 8 months earlier. Even Leo Miller, who had endured dangers and deprivations of his own during his descent of the Ji Paraná, had been horrified when he saw Roosevelt in Manaus, writing that his commander had wasted to a mere shadow of his former self. For his trip from Manaus to Pará, Brazil, Roosevelt had been transported to his steamship in an ambulance and carried on board on a stretcher. He had stayed in his cabin for most of the journey, unable to talk above a whisper and eating very little. It was not until the fourth day out that he was finally able to take a short walk on deck. But he had still needed help climbing down the ship's ladder when it reached Pará. Once he was on board the Aden, his appetite had improved tremendously, for books as well as for food. Not only did he regain 25 of the 55 pounds he had lost in the Amazon, but in the 1 week that it had taken the steamship to travel from Bridgetown, Barbados, to New York, he read dozens of books. In New York Harbor, however, it was clear to everyone who had turned out to welcome him home that, while Roosevelt still had the same fighting spirit, he had lost his legendary vigor. When his oldest son, Theodore Jr., offered his father his arm to help him negotiate a gangway, Roosevelt rebuffed him, snapping, "I am all right. I can take care of myself." Every man present had been ready to offer the same aid, had Roosevelt been willing to accept it. As he limped down the companionway, the impression was strong that the colonel had endured the greatest hardships of his life, a reporter for the New York Sun wrote. That was borne out when one of his friends remarked, "I guess the colonel will never take a trip like that again." After recovering from the gravest and most immediate effects of his illness, Roosevelt had been eager to tell the story of his expedition's journey. But the scale of that achievement was so extraordinary that, to his surprise and outrage, he was not met with praise, but with skepticism and disbelief. Even before he had left his hospital bed in Manaus, some of the world's most prominent and respected geographers had stepped forward to question his accomplishment. Among the first to plant a seed of doubt was Sir Clements Markham, a former president of England's famed Royal Geographical Society and the man who had sent Robert Scott to the South Pole. Markham, whose area of specialty was South America, and who had traveled extensively through the continent, scoffed that Roosevelt's expedition certainly is a very remarkable story. I feel somewhat incredulous as to Colonel Roosevelt having actually discovered a new river nearly 1,000 miles long, he told a correspondent for the New York World. A less eminent but arguably even more famous explorer, Henry Savage Lander, also attacked Roosevelt, even more directly and viciously. Lander, who had himself boasted of fighting his way through hundreds of miles of uncharted Brazilian wilderness, a feat that Rondon disputed, now called Roosevelt a charlatan, and charged that his trip suspiciously mirrored Lander's own. "It seems to me he only copied the principal incidents of my voyage," he sneered. "I see he has even had the very same sickness as I experienced, and, what is more extraordinary, in the very same leg I had trouble with. These things happen very often to big explorers who carefully read the books of some of the humble travelers who preceded them. I do not want to make any comment as to so-called scientific work of Colonel Roosevelt, but as far as I am concerned, he makes me laugh very heartily, and I believe all those who have a little common sense will laugh just as much as I." Roosevelt first learned of the attacks on his expedition when he was in Barbados. By the time he reached New York, he was incensed and determined to confront his detractors head-on. Several American geographers and newspapermen had leapt to his defense, including an editorial in the New York World that growled, "If the colonel says the river is 1,000 miles long, it's 1,000 miles long. We wouldn't knock off an inch to avoid a war." Roosevelt, however, was the kind of man who fought his own battles. As for Markham, Roosevelt told the New York Times the British geographer had unconsciously paid the greatest possible tribute to what he had done. If his expedition had not been one of great importance, Markham would not have bothered to attack it. Lander, on the other hand, he dismissed as a pure fake to whom no attention should be paid. These attacks on not just Roosevelt's expedition but his character only heightened the excitement surrounding the speech he agreed to give at the National Geographic Society on May 26th. The society, which had fought hard and, in Henry Fairfield Osborne's estimation, unfairly, for Roosevelt's first speech on the River of Doubt, had rented out Convention Hall, then the largest hall in Washington, D.C., for the event. Following a dinner at the New Willard Hotel, owned by Bell's father, Roosevelt rode to the lecture in a limousine, with Commander Robert Perry, the man credited with being the first to reach the North Pole, standing on the running board and leaning into an open window so that he could continue his conversation with the colonel. As Roosevelt entered Convention Hall at 8:30 p.m., 10 minutes late, an usher at the front of the auditorium caught sight of him and signaled his arrival by waving a white handkerchief. The audience leapt to its feet and erupted in thunderous cheers and applause. This was the only hall in Washington large enough to hold the Society's 5,000 invited guests, but it was far from luxurious. One reporter called it dingy and complained that it was ill-ventilated and situated on top of a huge retail market. It was also stiflingly hot on this, one of the hottest days of a notably steamy summer for Washington. As Roosevelt's venerable audience, which included everyone from ambassadors to Supreme Court justices to members of President Wilson's own cabinet, awaited his lecture, the stench of rotting meat and vegetables thickened the air around them. Also among the crowd seated in the auditorium were George Cherry, Leo Miller, Anthony Fiala, and Father Zahm. Since their journey had ended, Roosevelt had done what he could for each of the men of the expedition. He had invited the camaradas into his cabin on the Aden, saluting them as heroes and giving them each 2 gold coins as a parting gift. He had sung Colonel Rondon's praises everywhere he could be heard, ranking him as one of the 4 most accomplished explorers of his day. He had given Miller and Cherry each $1,000 for their next expedition and had pledged to raise more. And, in an effort to soothe his friend Father Zahm's bruised ego, he had asked Gilbert Grosvenor, the chairman of the National Geographic Society, to give the priest a special seat on the platform next to him during the speech. From the moment Roosevelt entered the hall, it was immediately apparent to his audience that he had yet to recover from the trials of his expedition. "The striking thing about Mr. Roosevelt tonight," one reporter wrote, "was that he looked tired, that his hands were cold and covered with perspiration, and his voice weak. His smile appeared to be forced, and he gave the impression of a man who was being sustained by willpower rather than by physical strength." Roosevelt, however, was also sustained by righteous anger. He was determined to set the record straight, no matter what the cost to his health. Asking the journalist in the audience to take careful notes, he snapped, "I want to call your attention to the fact that I am using my term to scientific precision, and when I say, put it on the map, I mean what I say. I mean that the river of doubt is not on any map, and that we have put it on the map." The speech left Roosevelt's detractors mute. Despite the miserable conditions and the fact that Roosevelt was so weak that few of the men in the audience could hear a word he was saying, "I sat in the front row and could barely hear him," Grosvenor would later tell his son. "I don't think 30 people could make out his words." Not a single member of the audience left the hall during the entire hour and a half lecture. After this speech, the New York Evening Journal reported the following day, "Any doubts that still linger about the River of Doubt hardly are justified. With a little piece of chalk, Colonel Roosevelt has put the River of Doubt upon the map of South America." Roosevelt's chance to face down his European detractors, from Markham to Lander to every chuckling newspaper man on the continent, came in mid-June, when he sailed to the continent to attend Kermit's wedding and speak before the Royal Geographical Society. As it turned out, Londoners were as eager to listen to what Roosevelt had to say as he was to be heard. Outside the front door of Burlington Gardens, 500 men and women clamored to get into a hall that already held 1,000 people and was equipped to hold, at the most, only 800. Lifelong members of the Royal Geographical Society, each of whom had been guaranteed a seat at the lecture, were furious at being excluded, some even vowing to resign. A zealous suffragette held tight to the coattails of a reporter in an effort to gain entry, and one man burst into tears of frustration. Even Lord Earl Grey, a member of the Council of the Society who was to be given a place of honor on the platform with Roosevelt, was forced, much like Corrine Roosevelt Robinson at Madison Square Garden, to scale a stone wall in order to get inside. Within the hall, every seat was taken, and the aisles were filled with the members of the council and their wives, who were forced to stand throughout the lecture. All the benches and gangways were filled. The gallery was packed to overflowing. People sat on the front of the platform, crowded round the entrances, and occupied every available inch in their eagerness to see and hear Mr. Roosevelt, a reporter for the Times of London wrote. In his opening remarks, Douglas Freshfield, the president of the Royal Geographical Society, concluded by quoting, "A high testimony to Mr. Roosevelt and his companions," from Roosevelt's most notable critic, Sir Clements Markham. Markham himself had failed to appear, explaining that he was ill, but his note was a gracious, if indirect, admission of defeat. By the time Roosevelt had finished his speech, rich with tales of disease-carrying insects and man-eating fish, and punctuated by his trademark high-pitched giggle, which sent his audience into roaring waves of laughter, nearly all of England had surrendered. Roosevelt had won again. He had humiliated his enemies, defended his expedition, and restored his reputation. However, he still had one insidious foe. The fever and infection that had nearly claimed his life on the River of Doubt, and which now refused to release its hold on his aging and overused body. When he docked in France on his way to Spain for Kermit and Belle's wedding, he had stepped briskly and declared that he had never felt better in his life. By the time he left Europe, however, his fever had returned, and he had to admit to his old friend Arthur Hamilton Lee that he was Not in good trim. Upon returning to the United States, Roosevelt got right back to work, writing dozens of letters and articles, attacking the Wilson administration and giving speeches on behalf of the sinking Progressive Party. In May, the Literary Digest had written that he would have to demonstrate his growing skill as an explorer and discoverer if he hoped to find any remnants of the party that he had helped to found just a few years earlier. The Progressive Party loyalists, insisting that they had a bright future before them, had continued to resist the advances of the Republican Party. By 1916, however, the party had gasped its last, and most of its members quietly disappeared within the Republican fold. The following year, Roosevelt's driving ambition turned from politics back to the military, and he became obsessed with leading a regiment to war, as he had done a quarter century earlier. This time his sights were set on Europe and World War I, but President Wilson, perhaps simply believing him unfit for such a position, or perhaps fearing that his old rival would return home a reminted war hero and an unbeatable adversary in 1920, refused to let him go. Roosevelt's only consolation was that he had four young, healthy sons who could fight and, if necessary, die for their country. True to their father's ambitions and teachings, each son fought to be the first to get to the front. Each conducted himself honorably and bravely on the battlefield. Three were wounded, and the fourth, Quentin, who would always be Edith's baby, was killed. The death of his beloved Quennikins devastated Roosevelt. Months after the news had reached him at Sagamore Hill, friends had glimpsed him alone in his barn one day, his arm around his horse's neck, sobbing. Death in battle was the kind of ending that Roosevelt had always imagined for himself, not for his sons, and his role in urging them to fight and risk their lives weighed heavily on him. Instead of dying in combat or on a remote, unexplored river, the ex-Rough Rider himself was destined to die slowly, ingloriously, and for those who loved and admired him, far too soon. Early in 1917, Roosevelt had begun what was to be his final physical decline. He spent the month of February at Roosevelt Hospital in Manhattan, writing to Kermit that his ailment stemmed from his old Brazilian trouble. Both the fever and the abscesses recurred, and I had to go under the knife. In October 1918, Roosevelt turned 60 years old. Although sick, frustrated, and broken-hearted over Quentin's death, he continued to fight, refusing to bow to the sorrow and grief that he had outrun his entire life. When the young die at the crest of life in their golden morning, the degrees of difference are merely degrees in bitterness, he had written to his sister Corrine. Yet there is nothing more foolish and cowardly than to be beaten down by sorrow, which nothing we can do will change. By November he was back in the hospital, so ill he was hardly able to walk or even stand. When told that he might be confined to a wheelchair for the rest of his life, Roosevelt paused and then replied, "All right, I can work that way too." He returned home to Sagamore Hill on Christmas Day. At 4 a.m. on January 6, 1919, James Amos, the man who had long been Roosevelt's loyal valet, awoke with a start from his chair near Roosevelt's bed, which had been set up in what had once been the family's busy second-story nursery. The sound that had awoken Amos was a hoarse, strangled breathing. The sound of Theodore Roosevelt dying. Amos alerted Roosevelt's nurse, who rushed to get Edith. By the time she reached her husband, he was already dead. For the country that he had served and inspired for so many years, and which was still reeling from World War I, Roosevelt's death was as stunning as it was painful. The newspapers the next morning were filled with long obituaries and pictures of the former president with his famous big teeth and pince-nez. But for most Americans, his death still seemed impossible. A man like Roosevelt could never die. When John Burroughs was asked for a remembrance of his old friend and fellow naturalist, he spoke for a grieving nation when he wrote, Never before in my life has it been so hard for me to accept the death of any man as it has been for me to accept the death of Theodore Roosevelt. A pall seems to settle upon the very sky. The world is bleaker and colder for his absence from it. We shall not look upon his like again. Of the men who had planned and led the descent of the River of Doubt in the spring of 1914, Roosevelt was not the first to die. Just 3 years after the expedition completed its journey, Rondon's faithful lieutenant and longtime companion, Juan Salustiano Lira, drowned while attempting to survey the Rio Sepotuba, the river that Roosevelt and Rondon had steamed up on their way to Tapirapoan and the commencement of their overland journey. As the current swept him to his death, Lira's last act was to throw his survey notebooks onto the riverbank so that they would be spared for posterity. A tribute to the teachings of Rondon, who had so often asked him to risk his life in the pursuit of a greater cause. After his abrupt dismissal from the expedition, Father Zahm, the co-planner of Roosevelt's journey, continued to write about travel to distant lands, but never achieved the fame he had so long dreamed of. To the extent that his family name was to make headlines, it was his brother Albert, rather than Father Zahm, who was to earn them, becoming a key figure in one of the nation's most notorious attempts to rewrite history. As head of the Smithsonian Institution's Aerodynamics Laboratory, Albert Zahm became a principal proponent of the contention that the Smithsonian's former director, Samuel Langley, had invented the airplane before the successful flight of the Wright brothers' famous flyer in 1903. The controversy generated by that claim, now widely discredited, so angered the Wrights that in 1928 Orville Wright chose to donate the original Wright flyer to the Science Museum in London, rather than permit it to be displayed in the United States. Only after a new regime at the Smithsonian retracted Zahm's claims was the flyer finally returned to the United States in 1948. At work on a new travel book, Father Zahm himself fell ill and died at age 70 in Germany, and his body was returned to the United States for burial at Notre Dame, where a campus hall now bears his name. Despite the many close calls of George Cherry's adventure-filled life, he died in bed after a long retirement with his family on his beloved Vermont farm. After his expedition with Roosevelt, he continued his work as a field naturalist in South America for several years, collecting more than 100,000 birds over his lifetime. But the call to Rocky Dell had always been strong, and one day he finally went home for good. He loved fishing for brook trout in the stream that ran through one of his fields, tending his bees and spending time with his grandchildren, who thought that he was the biggest man in the world. He died at Rocky Dell in 1948, when he was 83 years old. Only one man in the expedition lived longer than Cherry. Despite the near constant hardship and danger of his chosen career, Candido Rondon lived to be 92 years old, 32 years longer than Roosevelt. Rondon's telegraph line, the central achievement of his life, was finally inaugurated on January 1, 1915, less than a year after he and Roosevelt had completed their journey. The telegraph line, however, was fated to fall obsolete in much less time than Rondon had taken to build it. The same year the line opened, radio telegraphy found its way to Brazil, rendering unnecessary the copper telegraph wires that Rondon and his men had strung across 800 miles of the country's uncharted interior. Like Roosevelt, Rondon returned home a hero and remained one for the rest of his life. He was hounded by photographers and journalists, invited to meet the president of Brazil, asked to run for political office, an opportunity he repeatedly declined, and promoted first to brigadier general and then, near the end of his life, to marshal. In the 1920s, after meeting Rondon on a trip to Brazil, Albert Einstein nominated him for the Nobel Peace Prize, and in 1956, the Brazilian government renamed a territory of 94,000 square miles, nearly twice the size of England, Rondônia, in his own.